to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 7th, 2026. I'm your host, Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. We're continuing to explore our archives this week to share an episode from 2013 called The Dissenters. This episode is all about people refusing to sit back and wait for change. We're tracking the birth of Unifor and sharing stories of folks across the country standing up for themselves, whether in massive coalitions or completely solo. You'll hear from Unifor, Regina Water Watch, and a woman holding a one-person protest for Syria on Parliament Hill. From September 2013, here's that episode. Take a listen.
In our democracy, holding a protest sign is a pretty basic right of freedom of expression. Or is it? Red Eye host Jane Williams gets the story from one woman who was stopped by the RCMP for doing just that, holding a sign.
On August 30th, Jeanne Broughton and her friend Janet Harris held up a sign on the sidewalk near the Prime Minister's office in Ottawa. The sign read, "Please don't attack Syria. Enough people have died." They hadn't been there 5 minutes when they were approached by an RCMP officer who asked to see their permit. Jeanne Broughton joins me on the phone this morning from Toronto to pick up the story. Hello, Jeanne.
Hello, Jane.
So you're on the sidewalk with your sign. He asks you for your permit. What happened next?
Well, I kind of gawked at him because I was really surprised to be asked for a permit. I had heard that people got permits in order to do massive demonstrations on Parliament Hill, but we weren't there, and it was just Janet and I. So I just said something polite, like, "Oh, a permit?" And so he continued to talk to me about a permit being necessary and the fact that we had put up a sign, made what we were doing a protest, and it was necessary to have a permit for a protest.
So did you put your sign away then?
Well, Janet and I sort of looked at each other, and I said to him that we were expecting another friend, and that I would put my sign away until the other friend came, and then we would have some consultation and decide what to do. So, yeah, I did put my sign away.
What did the officer do then?
He started talking about if we thought that Syria shouldn't be attacked, then what did we think should be done in a case where a government was attacking its own people. And Janet engaged him in conversation about the general happenings that have been going on in Syria in the past 2 or 3 weeks. And I just listened to their conversation. I was surprised that the RCMP officer thought it was appropriate to engage us in a discussion about the issue. But I wasn't going to try and shut down the RCMP officer.
Right.
In fact, I didn't really know he was an RCMP officer. He had just got out of a black car that was idling in front of the PMO's office. You know, it's a huge sidewalk there, and there was already a black van and then this black sedan parked up against the building right on the sidewalk, and there was space even for another 2 or 3 cars there, and people could still walk past. So he got out of this idling black car and came to talk with us, and he was just wearing a gray shirt and some black pants, and there's a little pin on his shoulder that has a maple leaf flag on it and the letters PM. And he's got no other badge or other identifying marks other than these little wires that come out of the ears of security guards, you know, gear that they wear.
So then your friend Colin Stewart came up to join you.
Right.
What happened then?
So it was kind of difficult for us to have our little conference between the three of us because the guard stayed right there with us. Colin sort of whispered that perhaps since we hadn't planned to have any kind of confrontational event happen here, that it was just as well to keep the sign in the bag and that we could, just quietly remain there. So that's what we did.
So now when you got home, you wrote an email to the Ottawa Citizen. What did you have in your email?
I just told what had happened and asked the Citizen if they would ask their readers if they know of any requirement for a permit in any legal sense from the federal, provincial, or city regulations. And because of that contact to the Ottawa Citizen, it was their letters to the editor page where you on their website. I just sent the message from there. One of their reporters contacted me, Hugh Adami, and he was very interested to know what had happened with this event, and also the Citizen put their people on finding out exactly what the requirements are about protests and permits.
And then I guess Janet, your friend Janet Harris, also contacted a city councillor and then found out more about what the permit regulations are. So what are they?
Well, essentially, both the city and the RCMP, which is responsible for what happens on Parliament Hill, have a permit process which they prefer people to use when they are planning to organize a large demonstration that might block traffic and where there might be a need for some kind of police attendance in the sense of protecting the people who are protesting and you know, in case there might be some kind of collateral damage. That's the way they frame it. It's essentially, we prefer people to get permits, but there's no requirement for a permit. And the main purpose is about large demonstrations that might block traffic.
Were you actually on the hill?
No, we were on the sidewalk at the corner of Wellington and Elgin. You can't even see the Peace Tower from there because there's some things blocking the way.
So you wouldn't actually have been within the RCMP's jurisdiction then where you were?
No, not at all.
And the sidewalk was pretty big. I guess you weren't blocking anybody.
No, not at all. The officer, in some of his comments, did say, and you must not impede traffic. And we smiled at him. No, we're not doing that. We're not impeding anybody here.
Now, I understand that this is the first time that you've done something like this, sort of taken the initiative personally to do something like this, rather than be part of a bigger organized action, which you've also done. What is it about the plans to attack Syria that made you want to take this step?
Colin had circulated an email the night before to a large list of his friends, and in that message there was a link to a CBC report that said that our prime minister had been talking with the president of the United States about the possibility of attacking. And I've been deep in my own work, you know, for months and didn't realize that this had come to this kind of a head. And I just thought, now's the time to say that a military attack is not going to help. I actually went on to the prime minister's website to send him a message. And when I pressed send, I got the message, server error, so email isn't going to work. So since I'm in Ottawa, I might as well make a sign and go and stand in front of his office.
What do you think, in retrospect, now that you've had a chance to reflect on it, about the efforts of the RCMP officer to argue with you about that?
Well, I certainly hope that he has learned a lesson. The Ottawa Citizens researchers have clarified the point that permits aren't required, and that that to interfere with people who are exercising their constitutional rights really isn't the role of the RCMP.
That was G.N. Broughton on the Red Eye podcast speaking about how the RCMP stopped her from holding a protest sign. Now, Rabble won't stop you from listening to any show on the Rabble podcast network. In fact, it is free to do so. Go to rabble.ca/podcasts. Over the last several decades, there has been a trend in government to award private control of infrastructure intended for the public good. A case in point, Regina, Saskatchewan's municipal government is trying to build a new wastewater treatment facility using what is called a public-private partnership, or a P3 agreement. This agreement would give a private company exclusive control over the city's water for a period of 30 years. Citizen advocacy group Regina Water Watch has forced a referendum on keeping the wastewater facility public, and that referendum is upcoming. Scott and I spoke with activist Jeremy Campbell about the campaign, and we start with his explanation of public-private partnerships.
A P3 agreement is a public-private partnership, which is where a public project is taken on by both government finances and private finances. And so how that works is, in our P3 specifically, we will have to take on a private partner for the building, financing, maintaining, and every single aspect of the building for the next 30 years in the contract. And the only incentive for us to take on the project is a $58 million grant from the federal government, in which they say that the only reason they're granting to P3s is because it is somehow more efficient, but there has been zero evidence thus far proving such.
And give me an overview of the concerns that the group has with this model of doing things.
There's just a lot of moral and scientific issues behind it. For one, if you just look at examples from around the world, specifically like in the States and in Hamilton.
Just quickly interrupting to note that when Campbell references Hamilton here and later in the interview, he's talking about Hamilton, Ontario.
And everywhere, people are moving away from private partners for their water maintenance. For example, like France, Argentina, the Suez Company, all these large companies are being kicked out because service charges do go higher with private partners and water quality does lower. For example, if you look at Hamilton, when they took on their wastewater treatment facility with a private partner, later on sewage started showing up in the lake, raw sewage, and the city had to take the building and its maintenance back into public hands after a long struggle. On top of environmental concerns, so like dropping of service, the fact that you would have to sign a 30-year agreement with a private company is just unsustainable to us. Most companies do not last longer than 30 years, for one. And secondly, our biggest concern is the democratic principles behind it, because we lose all control over water resources in a 30-year contract. And whereas if it was kept public, we could always elect new officials to fix the problems.
Tell me a bit more about why, or your understanding of why it is that service charges go up and quality goes down when the management is privately done.
Well, you got the common sense that you need to make profits. And it just does not make any sense, considering that all the funding for the project will come from the city and that we're supposed to expect the private partner to magically create efficiencies, whereas he still has to make a profit. So it just defies common sense, for one. But secondly, our organization takes very seriously the scientific facts in our arguments, and we've contracted an independent economist and consultants to look at the problem, and it just costs more in general because of private interest costs. When a company needs to help finance the project, they take on more debt, and that debt eventually gets laid off onto the public because we take on all expenses in the contract. So it just costs more, and it just doesn't make any sense.
And what about the quality side of it? Why is there an observable decrease in quality?
Again, with just think about the common sense. If you're a water company, there's three ways you're going to make money. It's charging people more for your water, charging the city more, or it's going to be by lowering your costs of serving the water, so replace your workers or whatever it may be, lowering the service costs. And the other one is to sell off the water resources, which is another thing we're seeing in Regina. Our wastewater final product is being diverted from the natural waterways and being sold off to potash companies for something called saline mining. There's a lot of environmental concerns with the use of water being commodified, because Regina Water Watch's view is water is not a commodity. It is a natural resource and a right for all humans.
So tell me about the state of things back in March when the group came together. Had the city council made a final decision about this, or they just proposed it? Where were things at?
They'd already decided it. They had decided to do that earlier on that year. There was just a lot of people mad about it because there was nothing we could do, it seemed, and people were just set that they knew it was going to cost more. And so people were talking, hey, like, let's just create a petition. Why not, right? And the idea just started floating around more and more, and then people decided, okay, we're going to make this petition. And a key thing we had to do was, in the past history of Regina, when people made petitions, city often rejected them for little errors, flaws, and so we had to hire someone to look over the petition to make sure it was legal. And on Water Day, we created the organization dedicated to getting this petition done.
So tell me about the process of getting the petition signed. What did your group do to get signatures?
Well, there's a number of things I'd like to share with the listeners on what we did and what we did that worked in making this happen, because there is a lot of resistance from governments that are seemingly bought out. In Saskatchewan, the law is that you can't have online petitions, so all of our petitions had to be on paper. You want to create as many petitions as possible, more than you will need, and then you want to distribute them and make a network of volunteers. You want to approach people at public markets, outside retail stores, and just get people to sign and ask if they'd like to help. And if people want to help, you give them lots of petitions. And you make specific where you return them. You have a phone number of which people can call if they want to have them picked up. And you just want to make us very accessible to everybody. And you want to have the petitions floating around everywhere in the city.
So you would do things like go to public places and ask for signatures? Would you go door to door and do that kind of thing?
Well, we found door to door is a little less effective. People aren't always home and whatnot, right? But when we would stand outside retail stores, there's a consistent flow of people. Public markets, there's a consistent flow of people. The entrances of festivals and concerts and whatnot. At events, we would often bring our own kiosk with marketing banners and stuff saying Regina Water Watch, and people would come and just sign the petition. And yeah, just stay public. The signatures just came in consistently, but it was in the last week when we put funding into Facebook promotions and seriously got activists going in the last week that we saw our numbers rise from 17,000 signatures to 24,000. And the key thing is social media and having the petition accessible on there. And what you want to do if you're promoting it on Facebook is you specifically want to promote few and strong posts about why water should remain public and use lots of scientific facts to back up your statements and create a lot of discussion. The most effective way is to have people share your posts. So if you pool your money into one strong post and release that and like have a link to printing out the petition, that can effectively gain you 5,000 signatures.
What kinds of things did ordinary people in Regina have to say about this, both things that were supportive of you and maybe some of the more skeptical responses that you got from people?
For the most part, people have no idea this is going on. They're like, what? Water's being privatized? I'm like, yeah, well, they're signing a private agreement to have a company come in. People had no idea for the most part. The few people that were like, yeah, there's 53 in here, were people who sincerely believe that this is the best thing. They believe that business does it better and they don't believe otherwise. That's fine. I respect that. The other kind of people that you would hear opposition from are just people saying, we don't want to give up that federal government money. That was the only real other argument for having a private company. And what I'm talking about is the federal government is granting infrastructure money only if we sign a P3 agreement to build our wastewater facility. That is the only real argument that the city has ever put towards following this path, which is why they have no evidence supporting any other reason.
And how do you counter that when you're talking to people?
We just tell them the facts. We say it costs more. Because one report we did with economist Hugh McKenzie found that it would actually cost millions more just going through a P3 through interest costs, even accounting for the $58 million grant. It costs more no matter what. And the other thing is you use moral arguments, strong moral arguments, such as it's undemocratic because when you do sign a 30-year agreement with a company, you have no democratic say in what that company does, whether you want to or not.
That was Scott Nye from the Talking Radical Radio podcast speaking with Jeremy Campbell about the fight to keep Regina's water treatment plant completely public. You can dive into the whole interview at the RPN. That's at rabble.ca/podcasts. Over the Labor Day weekend, a new union was formed in Canada. Well, more of a super union, actually. It is named Unifor, and it is made up of the members of the Canadian Auto Workers Union and the Communications, Energy, and Paper Workers Union. Unifor is now the largest private sector union in Canada. It represents more than 20 sectors. That's over 300,000 workers. The leaders of the new union say that Unifor will do things differently. Here is inaugural Unifor President Jerry Dias making the opening statement at his first Unifor press conference.
Today marks a complete way that workers had to look at their unions. Today is an opportunity for workers that do not belong to a union to take a look at what is happening today in Canada. We are forging a union today to do a variety of things. Number one, we're going to find and we're going to make sure that we take care of our members better than we have historically. Number two, we are going to make sure that we are going to put together an organization built from coast to coast to coast that understands the political challenges that are before us. Number three, we are going to put together an organization, and we have put together an organization that is sick and tired of playing defense, that is really looking forward to start playing offense. So today is really about changing the debate and the discussions in Canada. It's about changing the discussion about workers and workers somehow having to accept less. So today really is about moving forward. Today is about challenging the status quo, and today is about making sure that the governments have a formidable foe if, in fact, they decide that they're going to take on the trade union movement. We're formed today not because we're looking to pick a fight. Matter of fact, just the opposite. We're forming this organization today hoping that government will understand that working people have a major contribution in Canada. We formed our union today expecting respect. We formed our organization today saying that government should be sitting down with us and talking about the roles of unions and what we have to offer as it relates to the workers of Canada. But we're also forming a union today that says if people will not listen, and people will, then governments will disrespect. And if governments continue to attack the trade union movement, then we will have a response. So today is about building. Today is about building critical mass in our organization. Today is about making sure that our members are that much more secure than they were yesterday.
That was Jerry Dias, the president of the new union Unifor. You can hear the whole press conference on John Bonner's audio blog at rabble.ca/podcasts.
That was a clip from a 2013 episode of Rabble Radio called The Dissenters. To listen to the full original program, visit the link in the show notes of this episode. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Let's jump right in. This week's In Case You Missed It is presented by Rabble's Hannah Bowell.
Starting this week in national politics, ahead of building a $13 billion data center in collaboration with Meta Platforms Incorporated, the United Conservative Party has begun pushing pro-AI propaganda on the Government of Alberta website. This subsection of the site refers to data centers with the much more glamorous title of digital refineries, uses the same vague talking points and descriptions as the Meta spokesperson who announced the project on July 4th, and completely ignores addressing any regulatory concerns. Ledger polling firm recently ran an online survey of 1,000 Albertans, finding that resident support for the project went up about 13% following exposure to the province's talking points. Though, as arguments opposing the data centers gain more traction, it is likely this pendulum will soon swing back the other way. As trillions of dollars are being funneled into AI infrastructure, the question of whether or not this investment is justified still remains. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman wrote in his Substack that AI spending is only justifiable if it is able to provide the economic payoff as promised, and first movers reap a majority of these profits before second movers become worthy competitors. Hopefully, what he describes as, quote, the triumph of hype over experience, end quote, is coming to an end, allowing generative AI to go the way of Bitcoin and NFTs and fade out of use. In technology news, Leah Lagridel breaks down generative AI's energy use and environmental impact. Generative AI is the specific category of AI causing concern, where a user inputs a prompt and then the AI produces written, visual, or audio content. Generative AI causes greater environmental harm than standard AI systems in a variety of ways. Microchips demanding rare mineral resources at a rate that could deplete the supply by 2030. Graphics processing units, also known as GPUs, used to train generative AI models, use enough energy to power hundreds of homes for a year. And the sneaky implementation of generative AI into social media and web browsers makes usage of these technologies nearly unavoidable. The ethics of generative AI is another cause for concern. The use of generative AI to produce violent or sexual visual content of real people, including children, is becoming an increasingly crucial talking point as people continue to use generative AI tools for fun without considering the consequences of feeding personal data into these systems. While it may be true that individuals will never contribute the same amount of environmental damage as billionaires or corporations, choosing to use these tools responsibly can help to avoid needless environmental harm. As Lagridel writes, there is power in choosing to opt out of something that does more harm than good to both people and the planet. Also in national politics, Prime Minister Mark Carney's excessive military spending is sacrificing quality of life for Canadians. Without assessing our military needs, over $100 billion have been spent on submarines and fighter jets. Without consulting the public, he's introduced a plan to triple our military spending with an extra $150 billion allocated annually to the military by 2035. This plan was never mentioned prior to the April 2025 election. Canada actually ranked 6th among NATO countries in terms of dollars spent on the military before the funding increase. In falling victim to the military-industrial complex, social spending suffers the most, being treated as a luxury rather than an essential piece of Canadian quality of life. As the late US President Dwight Eisenhower said, quote, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fire signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed." End quote. Finally, in environmental news, despite a renewable energy revolution helping to slow the climate crisis, reducing pollution and creating jobs, people in power are refusing to be a part of it. Communities across the world are facing the consequences of the climate crisis, from wildfires to extreme droughts to devastating storms. The past 11 years have been the warmest on record, possibly the warmest the planet has ever been in 125,000 years. And climate change has been advancing faster than scientists initially predicted. It's well known that the climate crisis is fueled by burning fossil fuels and destroying carbon sinks such as forests and wetlands, yet our government continues funding these projects, even doubling down. In the case of Alberta's fossil fuel development, we continue to put life on our planet in jeopardy and miss out on economic opportunities due to our prioritization of short-term profit. More effective solutions exist, and it's about time we use them. As always, you can read the full versions of all of the stories talked about today on rabble.ca.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks so much for listening. To help support our show further, consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also choose to subscribe to us over on Patreon for special bonus content of Rabble Radio. If you're already subscribed, consider making a donation to rabble.ca at rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nuremberg for supplying the music to this episode. I'm Nick Seabrook, and we'll talk to you next time.